Good morning. On this 74th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, we remember a time when Americans knew who they were and what they were fighting for. But now, is the American identity changing? We speak with American Studies professor Bernadette Gonzalez. Meanwhile, the deadline to comment on the Department of Interior proposal for a government-to-government relationship is approaching. Kaylee Lopez, Board President of Imua Hawaii, joins us this morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkook. Sorting out the genuine from the fake in the world of alternative medicine, Dr. Mel Borens offers a physician's take on what works and what doesn't in A Doctor's Guide to Alternative Medicine. And Ballet Hawaii Artistic Director Pam Taylor Tong looks back on a life in dance.
Maybe a gentle way to get into a Monday morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and welcome to The Conversation.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning, Chris Vanderkook.
Coming to the end of a fairly important public comment period, yeah?
That is true, and one that we're going to talk about this morning. Now, you may remember that this fall, the U.S. Department of the Interior released a proposal to reestablish a government-to-government relationship between Native Hawaiians and the U.S. It's been the subject of confusion with the Na'iopuni Hawaiian self-governance election. Imua Hawaii Board President Kaylee Lopez says the two issues are totally separate, although there is a relationship between them. The often repeated refrain is that the proposed DOI rule would give Native Hawaiians a seat at the table and power to their voices. The comment period on that proposal, as Chris mentioned, is quickly approaching. It's December 30th, and Kaylee Lopez joins us now. Thank you so much for being here.
Aloha, Beth Ann. Thank you for having me here.
The idea that these two distinct issues have been conflated and look as if, you know, one becomes the pass-through for the other has been the subject of a lot of our conversation over the last couple of months to try to take it apart. But what do you think has been the sticking point in understanding that one doesn't necessarily preclude or advance the other?
Well, I think partly it's the fact that they're both happening at the same time makes it a little bit difficult. And the reality is if the federal rules are adopted and Na'iopuni convenes and develops a constitution, and as part of that constitution, if the government then comes together with the constitution and says, let's actually work towards federal recognition, that governing body then can use the rules that get adopted to then go to the Secretary of the Interior and say, we have gotten ratification, we have a large number of or broad-based support, we'd like federal recognition. So I think where they're intersected is, in fact, the degree to which the federal rules, if adopted, is an avenue for the Hawaiian government.
Because there would have to be a government to have a government-to-government relationship.
Absolutely. And that's what we've been lacking.
But it doesn't necessarily happen to be, or doesn't have to be, this one.
Right. I think the other thing that's confusing for people is much of the time the conversation is around federal recognition for Native Hawaiians. And the reality is Congress has, in fact, recognized Native Hawaiians as the indigenous people of Hawaii through the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act, through many different acts related to about 150 of them. So Native Hawaiians are, in fact, recognized as many other indigenous peoples of the United States. The only thing where there's disparity is that there is no government-to-government relationship because, as you said, there's no government. That's where Na'iopuni would come in and be able to, through that process, or if not Na'iopuni, whatever the future process is for developing a Native Hawaiian government.
But the point seems to be
you do need both if you want federal recognition.
But your point seems to be that regardless of what would happen with Na'iopuni right now, that without having a precedent, without having a rule to fall back on, 5 or 10 years from now, then this process would have to begin again. And then, according to all of you, that might be dicey given that we don't know where an administration might be then, but clearly you know where it is now.
Exactly, and that is our point. Our point is to really take advantage of the opportunity that's in front of us and keep that doorway open for the future. I think what also was confusing when the Department of Interior was here last time was that many of the people who submitted comments in opposition, it sounded like they actually thought we were going to be getting federal recognition as soon as the Department of Interior said yes, when in fact this rule has come out now. In fact, I think it was very responsive to many of the comments that people provided. And once the rule is adopted, it actually is just that. It's a framework for Native Hawaiian government that can sit on a shelf until such time that Native Hawaiians come together and say, yes, federal recognition is what we want. So that means we could, as a group, say 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now, say to the secretary, can you pull down that rule that was adopted by the Obama administration? We'd like to, in fact, seek federal recognition. You're right. If that doesn't happen during this administration, the likelihood of ever getting a rule passed is very slim to none. And my issue for anyone, no matter what your position is on independence or whatever, why would you want to close the door for your people? Why would you want to not have options available for the future?
So why do you think there is this sort of splintering of the Hawaiian community, which is really just communities? We can't even look at it as with a capital C, because there are so many various perspectives that we heard that came out of those DOI hearings from last year.
You know, I can't say. I wouldn't want to presume to know why those who are opposed to it. For some, and I'll go to what we heard when the Akaka bill was forefront. And for some, it didn't go far enough. So there are those who want there to be land claims. They want to see that there's an absolute securing of those assets for Native Hawaiians. And then there are those who wonder what is it, there are those who fear what it would mean for Native Hawaiians to, in fact, have the independence. for those, whether it's the Grassroots Institute folks in particular, I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't have a sense of what they're thinking as to why they wouldn't want to have this as an option. I guess for me, it's really difficult to understand why one wouldn't want to keep the options open for our people.
That option, though, comes with a fairly high threshold of 50,000 people. That's a pretty significant amount.
Yes, it is. So the Department of Interior rules does say if a Hawaiian government comes to the Secretary of the Interior and says, we have broad support, and this broad support is in favor of federal recognition, the Secretary can look at those numbers and feel very confident that it is broad-based and many of the Native Hawaiian people, in fact, do want it. And for some, that's too high. I think from our perspective, we want folks to be confident. We do want broad support. We don't want a minority of our community to force federal recognition on the broader group. So 50,000 is high. And at the same time, I think it's achievable. Why wouldn't we want that kind of broad support in order to move forward with federal recognition? If we can't get the 50,000, then we're not ready.
And that gives you your answer right there. All right, we're going to leave it there for the moment and see what happens as December 30th comes not too far from now. Anybody who wants to make a comment will have all that posted so that they'll be able to do that. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Kaitlee Lopez is Imua Hawaii's board president. As we just mentioned, those comments are due by December 30th on the proposal to reestablish a Native Hawaiian government-to-government relationship with the U.S. Also, we have a link to the Department of Interior's video about it on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
And this is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14 on the nose. Coming up, separating the panaceas from the snake oil in the world of alternative medicine. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, well, 74 years ago today, these words came over the airwaves from Honolulu. Quote, "This is no joke, this is a real war." That dramatic on-the-scene report came in the form of a long-distance phone call from a local radio reporter to the New York headquarters of the national broadcasting company's Red Network. He was reporting for the local NBC affiliate radio station, and he was the first reporter on the scene to reach the national airwaves. He was on the roof of the studio while the attack was still underway and described in detail the damage being done to the city. The situation on the ground was still chaotic. The Japanese had launched a total of 353 aircraft in the attack, leaving behind more than 2,400 dead, 188 planes destroyed, and 8 damaged or destroyed battleships. Hours into the attack, the reporter said, "This battle has been going on for nearly 3 hours. It's a real war. We cannot estimate how much damage has been done, but it has been a very severe attack." In today's backyard quiz, can you tell us the name of the radio station that broadcasts this historic report? Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Matson, whose charitable foundation awards donations, containers, and in-kind services in Hawaii and around the Pacific Basin. Matson.com/foundation.
Hawaii is probably more open to alternative medicine than many other places. Our cultural mix has added herbalists, acupuncturists, and any number of alternative practitioners into the healthcare mix, some of them with beneficial results, some without. We often hear of their supposed benefits through word of mouth, and Dr. Mel Borens, author of A Doctor's Guide to Alternative Medicine, What Works, What Doesn't, and Why, elected to take a more rigorous approach. He's on Maui to talk about his book. He's on the line with us this morning. Good morning.
Hey, Chris, good morning. Hello.
I'm glad to have the opportunity to talk to you, because as I was looking through your book, it occurs to me that so many of these alternative remedies come recommended by non-professionals. Your friend tells you that to take echinacea or St. John's wort, or they tell you about acupuncture. Have you found that to be true?
That's exactly true. You know, most of the stuff comes from the internet, from people, you know, friends, relatives, and also from health food store people who work there.
And it's getting medical advice from somebody who hasn't studied medicine is a pretty dicey proposition, isn't it?
Well, it is. You know, I had a patient on Thursday who came in and was taking something, and I said, "Well, who told you to take that?" And they said, "Well, the person, you know, at the health food store." Now, I'm not knocking people who work at health food stores. I think they're very knowledgeable about lots of things. However, you know, to be prescribing something to me is a bit awkward.
It's more than awkward. It's downright scary in some cases, yeah?
That's right. Yeah, sometimes it can be.
So what you've done is look at the things that get recommended by word of mouth and applied things like double-blind studies to them, right?
Exactly, Chris. You know, the randomly assigned double-blind control trials are what we as medical doctors believe tell us whether something works or not. We compare it to a placebo. The people who are taking it don't know they're taking it. The people who are giving it don't know which one they're giving, the placebo or the real thing. Yeah, so that's what we in medicine use as a basis for making decisions about what to do for people.
Well, because you've eliminated all kinds of very unquantifiable, unscientific variables, right?
Exactly, Chris. We take away the placebo effect, which is large in a lot of situations. We take away, you know, sometimes, things do work and for some people, but not necessarily for people when you look across a large numbers of people.
One of the things, Doctor, that I think would really muddy the waters here is that whole thing of the placebo effect, because if you're not that sick and you think a remedy is going to work, it's going to work, right?
Well, that's true. You know, the power of the placebo is, you know, we all understand that it has an impact. You know, some people believe 30% effect from the placebo. Lots of studies are being done, I talk about in my book about the studies that show how powerful the placebo can be. Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with the placebo. It's a wonderful ally for healing. But we can't rely on it as a guide to, you know, tell us what to do or not to do.
It'd be great if it worked in more cases. You could just sort of persuade somebody that they were going to get better, right?
But exactly. You know, the body is an amazing healer, and we have the potential, you know, to impact, how we heal. But, you know, there's certain conditions, you know, you could think all you want that you're going to get better, and you're not going to get better, right? It's the placebo won't be much help in those situations.
Of the different alternative medicines, and you go case by case through alternative medicines in your book, are there some that are just flat out don't work and are a waste of time?
Well, there are a lot that don't work. In my book, I don't talk much about what doesn't work so much, because there is so much that doesn't work. I'm colonics is an area that I've seen some harm with.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of not a big fan of colonic therapy, not to say that some people don't get some benefit, but I've seen some harm, you know, from it. And so I'm that's one kind of approach that I'm kind of not so supportive of.
Well, let me just ask you about that, because I've wondered about that myself. There's this new passion for cleansing the body, which was, after all, designed to hold a certain amount of waste material at any given time, right?
Yeah. Yeah, cleansing is really back, you know, it goes back a couple hundred years was a big theme. There's no question that when we eat healthy, we put healthy things into our body that makes a very positive impact. And that's about, you know, the extent of what I could say about it, you know. Cleansing diets or things like that, and flushing the body and all those things, I'm not really sure have been backed by science. Again, I don't say it doesn't work. I just haven't seen the research that shows that it makes a difference.
Do you find it an object of concern that an awful lot of medical advice gets passed around without benefit of science?
Some medical advice, even from physicians, you mean, gets passed around, sometimes not even supported with science. It's true. And it does concern me, because I see some of the harm. Somebody takes a herb, they think they're doing themselves good, but it impacts on their kidney, and they get kidney damage from the herb. And, you know, sometimes it's not always clear what's causing the problem. People present into the emergency with poisoning from lead, for example, that was contaminated from a herb that they bought back in Hong Kong or in China or in some other country, and no one really knows, well, what's going on here, until you kind of look at all the things that the person's taking and say, hey, you know, when you started that herb, your kidney test or your liver test started to go down, you know, start to be abnormal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I worry about. Or somebody who's avoiding getting medical care for a curable condition because they imagine that an alternative approach will work. Reminds me of a man with colon cancer. He was using a herbal tea because he was constipated, and he was using this for months and months and months, and he came to my office, and I diagnosed that he had colon cancer. He had surgery, and he was completely cured. However, he was thinking he was doing himself benefit by taking a herbal tea, for example.
When he was, in fact, postponing needed treatment at risk
to
himself, yeah?
Yeah, there's curative treatments. Doctors do have approaches that work and are successful. And, sometimes if you delay getting treatment for a condition, it just gets worse.
Well, Doctor, I thank you for taking the time, because it really seems in the direction of kind of unmuddying the waters, yeah?
Yeah, you know, there are approaches in alternative medicine that have been supported by science. There's randomly assigned double-blind control trials that show that they work, and I think, you know, that's an important thing to understand as well.
It certainly sounds it. Thank you so much, Doctor. I appreciate
it. Thank you.
Dr. Mel Bornes is the author of A Doctor's Guide to Alternative Medicine, What Works, What Doesn't, and Why. He'll present a free lecture next Saturday and Sunday at 6 p.m. at the Barnes & Noble Bookstore in Lahaina, Maui.
Mental illness is already a life sentence for some people who commit crimes.
They were either bipolar, schizophrenic, major depressive disorder. Most of them were on drugs. And these were the individuals that go to the penitentiary on a minimal sentence, be out in 6 months and back on the street.
Dallas District Attorney Susan Hawk says there needs to be an alternative to just prison. She's making one. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, protecting and managing Oahu's drinking water resources. Learn 7 ways to save water at boardofwatersupply.com.
Senator Schatz is back in Washington after 2 days at the Paris Climate Change Summit. And he thinks the draft agreement gives the world a fighting chance, to use his words, to counter global warming. Chad Blair from Civil Beat has a reality check on that optimism. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
To think that there's a draft that's, 200 nations are buying into is a pretty amazing thought. But to see that, it has a chance of working might be a different thought entirely. Because all of this is voluntary, is this optimism meant to be tempered a little bit?
Well, remember, 200 nations, but also in total representing 95% of the carbon emitters in the world. And, of course, we're right there at the top with China and India. And let's be realistic. There is some skepticism whether a draft agreement can really be enough to address the problem. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. But Schatz, who, as you know, has made the environment a big focus of his elections, of his work in the Senate. Remember, he's gotten a lot of money from environmental groups. He's had folks like Al Gore pushing for his election. He said he was actually surprised at how encouraged he was. It's easy to get, a little down about whether we can actually do something about global warming, climate change, given our reliance on fossil fuel, given the reluctance of some in this world to deny that, in fact, it exists. But Schatz told our Todd Simmons, one of our editors yesterday, that he actually does feel realistically that there's a fighting chance. And it was nice, he said, to experience some optimism for a change.
And we don't want to dilute that in some ways, but, being realistic about how that optimism translates into the actions that mean the ceiling of any sort of temperature rise at a level which most of the countries agree, whether it's that 2 degrees Celsius or as some of the Micronesian countries have been pushing for 1.5.
Oh, yeah. So this, I'm not going to, forgive me if I'm smoothing this over. In fact, there are some serious differences as to what should be done. You mentioned the 2 degrees Celsius. That's about 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. So the goal is to have a limit on temperature rise to that 2 degrees Celsius. Now, that's above pre-industrial levels. But folks in the Marshall Islands and Palau, which, as you know, we've reported on, they're only 6 or 7 feet above sea level in some cases. They say it should be more like 1.5 degrees Celsius. Other countries like Saudi Arabia, they're thinking 2.6, 2.7. Well, of course, Saudi Arabia is a large oil producer. They're worried about their economy and about jobs. So these are not small differences to paper over, and Schatz was certainly realistic. He said it's going to come down to a division of the responsibilities between developed nations like ours and rising nations, developing nations, particularly in South America and other places.
And how did he see that division happening?
Well, it's going to take a lot of discussion. The climate change talks continue, even though they started last week, and you had folks like Obama and then the leader of China and India and others there. The talks are continuing with the lower-level folks this week to try and get something out. He would like to see an agreement on this draft coming out of this whole thing. But, you know, we're not there yet. It's going to take a little while. But just the fact that China alone is involved is particularly encouraging, given that they are right at the top when it comes to carbon emissions.
Sometimes it's not just a thing, but it's also those that you can get involved with it who stand behind it. We'll see if they do. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, a little snoring is an annoyance, but a lot of snoring is something more, isn't it?
Well, it definitely could be. And for a lot of folks, when you hear the words sleep apnea, the first thing you think about is wearing a mask and having to put pressurized air into your breathing system at night. And it's kind of bulky and it's noisy and all these sorts of things.
Yeah.
But today we're going to talk with a dentist who actually specializes in some of the dental appliances that can help people that snore a lot, that don't have apnea, but can also help people who actually are diagnosed with apnea. And it's a much easier process to treat it than having to wear a mask. It doesn't replace the mask when you need that, but it's definitely another step you could take.
How does dentistry figure into all this?
You know, it's interesting because what happens is that it's the back of the throat that actually the smooth muscle collapses a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So when you reposition the jaw, when you bring the bottom part forward a little bit, it opens up the airway and you actually can breathe a lot better.
Interesting. So it's a procedure that a dentist can do.
Well, and it's even just something you can put in your mouth to wear at nighttime to help you so you can breathe, so that it doesn't even require a surgery in a lot of cases. So it's a different way to look at treating apnea than what we used to do. And it actually can be, for minor cases, just as effective. So it's a great alternative for those folks who are afraid to get the diagnosis because they're afraid of the major treatment.
So this is really just a very simple physical fix then.
Yep, could be.
Because it's like those things you can wear across your nose that open up the nasal passages slightly. That helps too, right?
That helps some folks where the obstruction is in the nose. And this is going to help people where the obstruction is back further down in the breathing tube, back towards mm-hmm. the back of the throat. So it is an alternative. And if it helps those folks who are afraid to get tested for apnea to realize that there's other treatments, then in and of itself, it's going to be helpful.
That's pretty welcome information, Kathy. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak, and that's tonight at 5.
A few years ago, we asked American Studies professor Bernadette Gonzalez whether the American identity was changing. At the time, we were considering that question as part of Independence Day celebrations. And on this 74th commemoration of the December 7th attack on Pearl Harbor, and with the recent high-profile clashes over whether or how to accept Syrian refugees, we thought we'd ask her again. And Bernadette Gonzalez is on the line with us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me this morning.
Good to talk to you again. It's been a couple of years since we've had the opportunity to talk. Have you seen any change in the way Americans are identifying as American, given the way that, you know, we have been brought up to think of certain American ideals and welcoming refugees, you know, Emeril Lazarus and all of that? Is there a change that you've been observing, or is this just more cosmetic?
I don't know that there's necessarily a change. I think it depends on which news you're listening to at any given moment, which news outlets you might be paying attention to. So I think it is something that's been consistent. You see folks espousing welcoming refugees when they see a lot of what's going on in Syria and what's going on across Europe with the Syrians fleeing a war-torn country. And then you see also a rise in nativist sentiment in the United States saying, we got to take care of our own because, and we can't, there's a sort of implied or not sometimes overt anti-Muslim kind of expression too. There's an association of all Middle Easterners with Islam. And right now, of course, there's a great deal of fear that is associated with being Muslim just because of what's going on in the Middle East. And so, you know, you see that both kinds of extremes at work.
Looking at how that impacts ideas of Americanism, I mean, either, you know, we take care of our own, but we need mm-hmm. to welcome those who need help. Traditionally, you know, we've done that in part, but not in whole. I mean, the sense of history that people sometimes forget is when we haven't done that, and when that has been to the peril of those who haven't been accepted, as well as to the American reputation. That's part of the concern that seems to be fueling the idea behind welcoming refugees. And yet, as you mentioned, there's a great deal of fear behind doing that, mm-hmm. especially given very recent events and concerns that somehow terrorists might sneak in with refugees. Is that something that Americans are looking at in depth, or are some of these things more knee-jerk reactions, as you say, depending upon what news service one describes to?
I look at my Facebook feed as a sort of to get a pulse of what folks are thinking, what kinds of memes are out there in terms of, what has some kind of popular, what has popular power. What's interesting is something I've seen lately is sort of this association with, hey, look, in World War II, there was a resistance on the part of the U.S. government to take in Jewish refugees. And, you know, there's an association with that kind of resistance today, that sort of unwillingness to take on. And that caused a huge humanitarian crisis that, had massive repercussions for a lot of people. And it's interesting to see sort of a history light kind of kicking in to make those parallels.
So talk more about that history light, because it sounds like you feel that there may be things that a lot of people may be missing in trying to compare those two different people.
Could you elaborate on that question a bit more?
When you talk about, you know, history light and what you're viewing in terms of how people viewed the lack of attention to taking Jewish refugees in during the time of the pre-World War II mm-hmm. and then afterward, and now how people are viewing Syrian refugees.
Right.
The flip side of that seems to be, well, these are not identical peoples with identical problems. Some, yes, but some not. And the fear that there might be terrorism sneaking in under the grace of goodwill and open arms, that might also
right.
be very different from what was happening in looking at whether or not to take Jewish refugees in the time of the World War, of the Second World War.
Sure. I mean, if anything, and this is my own personal take on it, the United States has a greater responsibility to take in Syrian refugees, primarily because its own interventions abroad, including Syria, have exacerbated the kinds of conditions that exist for Syrians in Syria. And so, you know, in some ways that kind of personal responsibility, if you will, is greater. And so in a sense, I think that the whole fear of the refugee as sort of a mask for terrorism, I mean, you know, not a single refugee in the history of the United States, as far as I can tell, has ever been at the head of a terrorist campaign against the United States. And so it's kind of interesting to see where this fear is coming from. And I mean, I would say a lot of it is racially based, is sort of a conflation between race and a fear of Muslimhood.
As that affects how people are viewing their own American identity, what would you tell them?
What affects, I'm sorry?
As what you've just said in terms of how you are viewing or what you've seen happen on your Facebook page and the conversations about whether or not to take Syrian refugees, How do you think that affects people's identity, their American identity, or what are they missing?
I think it depends who you are and what your approach is to it. I think a lot of folks who, some of whom are American immigrants, see an empathy towards, displaced peoples and peoples who have to migrate for reasons of, economic reasons as well as sort of desperation. And other times you see a rise in nativism akin to what you saw in the early 1800s when there was a great deal of immigration from the wrong parts of Europe and Asia. So, you see this kind of thing sort of flare up every now and then when there's sort of an incoming group that is not seen as belonging.
Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Bernadette Gonzalez is Associate Professor of American Studies and is also the chair of the Undergraduate Research Opportunities Council at Manoa. Her research and teaching focus on tourism, militarism, transnational cultural studies, feminist theories, and post-colonial studies, among others.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we thought about one of the ways the news of the Pearl Harbor attack was broadcast to a stunned nation that Sunday morning 74 years ago. While the attack was still underway, a Honolulu radio reporter went on the roof of his studio and managed to get through to New York and the National Broadcasting Company's Red Network news desk with a dramatic description. He was on the roof of his station studio filing his report when a Honolulu operator came on the line and cut him off to put through an emergency call. Ironically, his station's strong AM signal had been used by the Japanese Imperial Navy to hone in on their target. We asked you the name of the local NBC affiliate that was first on the air with an eyewitness account, and the answer is KGU.
And Warren Haynes knew that, called us from Kahului, Maui, and we'll be getting the T-shirt.
And at 8:44, that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, good morning. I'm Paul Mitri. I'm the chair at UH's Theater and Dance. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Stargazer time. Time for a look at what's happening in the gigantic universe around our really tiny planet. As usual, we turn to Christopher Phillips, Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee, for this week's report. We welcome him back now. Hey, Christopher, what's going on?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be back. For this week, stargazers, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn can be seen during sunrise. The four planets will appear as three bright star-like objects during dawn. This makes them very easy to spot, of course. The moon is waxing this week and will be almost a quarter full by week's end. This means great stargazing for everyone here in the islands.
But that does not mean you'll be able to see the cat in space that they discovered with one of the Mauna Kea telescopes, right?
That's right. The Gemini Observatory atop Mauna Kea has been working in concert with the Chandra X-ray Observatory in space and the Hubble Space Telescope to study a distant group of galaxies that resemble a grinning Cheshire cat, reminiscent of Alice in Wonderland.
Does that mean we'll have a better name for this one than QRC95?
I'm hoping so.
Call it Fuzzy or Fluffy or something. And so how do they end up looking like a cat, Christopher?
Well, this bizarre arrangement of galaxies is actually an illusion caused by light bending as it travels through space. It's something we call gravitational microlensing.
That's a heavy word you just used right there. We'll leave that to professionals like yourself. And that means that it must be bending light, right, to make this illusion?
That's absolutely right. When we look at the image, we see normal galaxies, but also thin streaks and curves of light. These are actually galaxies in the background. their images have been distorted by the galaxies in the foreground. My favorite way to visualize this is to hold up a pair of pint glasses to your eyes. If you look through the glasses, you will see the world looks distorted and curved.
But in space, it's space and time that's curving, not glass.
That's exactly it. In space, it's the shape of space and time that are causing light to bend. This curve is caused by really massive objects like galaxies. It's all a bit like the world of Alice when she steps through the looking glass.
That's exactly what I was thinking. And you can look for that at our website, too, right? We've got an image at HawaiiPublicRadio.org with our Stargazer post.
That's right. You can see this image online at our website.
And Christopher Phillips, Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee, thank you very much for the report.
You're very welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from HTA, a public charter school serving students grades K through 12 on each island, providing each student with the opportunity for a personalized learning plan combining face-to-face and virtual instruction. Learn more at myhta.org.
It's not easy to sustain a career in dance for decades after your performing days have wound down. But Pamela Taylor Tong, Artistic Director of Ballet Hawaii, has had an enviable career, a result of her love of her art and her sheer persistence in pursuing it and in passing it along to others. This holiday season, she'll be watching her young charges take the stage for her 30th presentation of The Nutcracker, and we talk with her about the rewards and challenges of the dancer's life.
For some reason, I keep thinking of the statement that it's not what I do, it's who I am. And at every point, I seem to be in the right place at the right time, and to really just, in my mind, meeting a need. Mm-hmm. And when I moved here to marry my husband, I had retired from Atlanta Ballet. I was a dancer, but then I was on the artistic staff or as a ballet mistress. So I would rehearse and do a lot of the things that organizing, and then I would jump into parts that I'd already done if somebody got injured. And so I had to decide on the course of events, and I married my husband, Ronnie Tong, and moved to Hawaii, thinking, as I told you, I had retired. And then I had had a number of different contacts on the mainland through the company, and Sonia Arava and her husband, Tor Sutkowski, was doing a production of Cinderella. So I happened to help them in rehearsing 12 Little Dragonflies. And at that point in time, the school was started again. I started the school with 12 students under the auspices of Friends of the Ballet, which was the company that supported the Honolulu City Ballet that was started by Mayor Fossey in 1976.
So, Pam, what you've seen in the course of your life is, as you say, it's not what you do, it's who you are. So there is a certain personality type that is ideally adapted to what you've done. And I would expect that you come pretty close to having that.
Type A driven.
That ideal personality type, right? As you teach and as you see young students of the ballet, are you able to address that with them and say, you know, you have to have this passion and have them sort of navigate through the inevitable difficulties of taking on that life, yeah?
I think that what I see is you see young dancers with stars in their eyes. You know, they love everything in pink. We are developing our young boys' classes and trying to promote that because it really is good for all athletics as well, too. It develops stretch and strength and stamina, and I see that. And then as they go through the years, there is a point in which they have to make a choice either to pursue that. Mm-hmm. A lot of them really go on. It's good for their college apps. It's good training. It helps the focus. And it also, I think, if you have a passion for something, it keeps you out of trouble.
Sure.
But and we have a number of dancers that went on to professional companies, but a lot of them went to college, perhaps danced in the college companies that they're in. I have two dancers that are in Yale that are dancing with that company connected with a college. And then many others that go on and just love it, become audience members, board members. You know, they're still involved and supporters of the arts. I also wanted to say that it's important for me because I had to stop because my parents didn't have the funds in order to continue my training, is that we do have a scholarship program, and it is a work scholarship so that there is an exchange and they understand giving back. And so that's been a joy, too, to see.
When you commit to the life of the dancer, I console myself as a musician with the thought that if I practice and don't get arthritis, that I'm going to get better, even at an advanced age. But in dance, your body is going to peak. And so in a way, your creative capabilities are going to reach a peak, and then you've got a lot of life after that. Not everyone finds that an easy adaptation, right? How do you prepare people for that?
I think that you have to be realistic, and then if you are still dancing, dance the roles that are suited for bodies that are older. I think that that's something that, and if someone is an artist, a dancer is an artist, that, you know, that transition, I think, goes naturally. But dance life is difficult. When I was in Atlanta dancing, we did a company class for 2 hours. We had a 15-minute break. We rehearsed for 3 hours. We had a lunch break, and then we rehearsed for 3 more hours. And then if we were in performance, then we would go to the theater, warm up, and then perform. But it was glorious. We performed in the Fox Theater for our Nutcrackers, and that is a beautiful, beautiful theater. It's an incredible cast. They're family. They have been coming, several of them, through many years of my tenure.
Nutcracker has introduced, probably Nutcracker and Swan Lake are tied for having introduced the most people to the dance. So you get to see that year after year.
I do. It's a holiday tradition, and I think that people come to see that because of the spirit of it and the wonderful dream that she has during that time, you know, when it's Christmas Eve and she's going into the house and there's a Christmas party. And so they go through the whole thing, going to the land of the sweets. And it's very magical.
Yeah. Well, ballet in general has been pretty magical for your life.
It has been. And I think it's wonderful to be able to teach. I don't teach the 3-year-olds, but I do the 4 and 5-year-olds. And I like to have my knowledge of every student that is in the school. And so I see them grow up. One of the dancers that has grown up in the school danced with Orlando Ballet, and she got her degree online, Harvard, online while she was dancing in Orlando Ballet, and has now got her white coat this summer, I believe she did, and she's going to be in the party scene, and now she's in medical school, going to become a doctor. And of course, Amanda Shule, that grew up here and went to San Francisco Ballet, but then also did Center Stage and Mal's Last Dancer. And so it is, you know, wonderful to see them grow up from when they were little and grow. I guess when they start bringing their grandchildren, maybe that's the time for me to retire.
Pamela Taylor-Tong is the Artistic Director of Ballet Hawaii, celebrating her 30th anniversary with the company, with 3 performances of The Nutcracker, Friday, December 18th, Saturday, December 19th, and Sunday, December 20th in the afternoon at the Blaisdell Concert Hall.
Support for The Conversation comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
For new letters on the air, Marilyn Callett talks about her Book of Hanukkah Tales that includes her mother-in-law's ever-changing recipes.
I'd say, Hilda, these are your recipes you gave me. No, you could put a little less butter. So the fine-tuning is left up to the cooks.
Poet Marilyn Callett reads from One for Each Night while we try the recipes next time on New Letters on the Air.
Tuesday evening at 6:30.
Beth Ann, I wonder how many children there are scattered throughout the world who have done a nutcracker at some point in their early lives.
And how many of them might have been taught by Pam Taylor Tom?
Quite a few, at least here in
with
Hawaii.
With a 30-year career, that's pretty astounding, given the fact that one, you know, looks at ballet sometimes as being a finite thing.
Yeah.
But she was able to make that transcendence from just being a performer, which she did well, but also in giving such a gift of dance to so many students over the years.
Yeah, and as she herself said, she's got the personality for it. And what did she say? It's not what you do, it's who you are, that she just knew early on that she was a dancer and made a dance life for herself.
I'm curious what she does from now. How do you take a 30-year career and walk away from it, which she clearly decided that it was time for her to do.
Yeah, well, it hasn't happened yet, so we can look forward to at least some more performances, yeah?
Well, at least three performances of the Nutcracker. Well, that's going to do it for us on this Monday on December 7th. There are the lots of good things that we'll be talking to you about over the week, and starting with getting an update from Neil Conan in Paris. We're also going to get an update on the Radio Flyers program, Family Fund.
And we're going to talk to author Susanna Moore about her take on Hawaii's history. Our talkback line is always open. If you have something to say about anything you hear on the show or on the station, call us at 808-792-8217. And you also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
We're on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. We tweet at HI Conversation, or get to me at BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on the HPR2 archive. Links to more information about guests and topics are there, too. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HPR2.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning for more of the Conversation.